room to put the medicine in and stir it, and then eat it quickly, drink this vodka mixture, which they apparently had mixed up, and then lay back and rest quietly.
Here among the eucalyptus trees, there's a fresh wind from the Pacific as Southern Californians prepare for a weekend of the usual pleasures, surfing, swimming, beautiful people in a rich land. Perhaps we may never understand what makes apparently intelligent men and women kill themselves to achieve a meeting with a passing alien spaceship. But as the millennium approaches, we may have more opportunities to find out.
That report by Gavin Esler. Like many pressure groups and religious sects in the United States, Marshall Applewhite and his Heaven's Gate organization used an internet website to advertise their unusual beliefs. But how important are these worldwide connections in spreading the off-center beliefs of cults like Heaven's Gate? I spoke to Andrew Brown, a specialist in religion and the internet. I asked him how far Heaven's Gate used the new technology to try and spread the word.
There's no doubt that they're trying to use technology to recruit new members. I doubt that's a very effective way to do it, partly because the marketplace is very crowded. It is very, very easy to set up a site on the internet, and if you do so, you will find yourself competing with literally millions of others.
It's always seemed to me that the essence of cults from the Hare Krishna people onward was to get you in direct one-to-one contact with someone, you know, literally eye contact, so that they would convince you in a Svengali-like fashion.
They use that at the final stage, but they all put out books, for example, which are not one-to-one contact, and they all put out videotapes and tapes and so on and so forth, which are, as it were, tentacles which will be used to draw you in. And I think that the internet is something rather like that.
Is there something about the internet, you know, the colours, the mysterious sound effects, that might draw in impressionable people more readily?
I don't think so. I think you'd have to be very impressionable indeed. I mean, you know, it's much, much less glamorous or impressive than television.
The fact that this mass suicide, though, has been connected in the popular press with its internet site very directly, is this likely to lead to pressure now on legislators to bring in some nebulous form of control?
No, I think the pressure for that will come from the pornography question. We don't censor books because a lot of books can contain lunatic, cultic assertions. I don't think the internet by itself did anything to recruit people to this cult, even. The point is, two things have got confused. They used their internet skills as a way of earning money. The things they did with that were very boring, very professional, very commercial. There's millions of people around the world trying to make money making websites. They also, and quite separately, had a sort of cult website selling their beliefs. This was actually much less professional, much less attractive, and much less interesting than the one selling their skills.
The trouble is, although this website may not have worked, it does make sects much more obvious. It brings them above the surface, and this may have prompted President Clinton to these very public words of concern and condemnation. It's giving the impression that there are more cults around than there used to be, and that may not, of course, be the case.
I think there probably are slightly more cults around than there used to be, and the internet does mean that you can broadcast all over the world, but it also means that everybody else can. You know, the internet is a very good place to get messages to people who already believe you, but it's a lousy way to pick up converts.
Andrew Brown. The British Medical Association, the organisation that represents doctors in the United Kingdom, has rewritten the Hippocratic Oath, the ancient code of medical practice written in the 5th century BC by the physician Hippocrates. The new version will be presented to the World Medical Association at its next meeting in May in the hope it will be accepted for use worldwide. The Hippocratic Oath, which has set the ethical rules for medical practice, obliges doctors to do no harm to their patients and to keep medical secrets and so forth. It begins with a prayer to Apollo, the ancient Greek god of medicine. And so when I spoke to Dr. Sandy Makara, chairman of the BMA, I asked him how the rewritten Hippocratic Oath would sound.
The new one starts by saying the practice of medicine is a privilege which carries important responsibilities. And then it goes on to make clear that all doctors should observe the core values of the profession, and these center on the duty to help sick people and to avoid harm. It's very positive. Everything is or almost everything, is affirmative rather than negative, as it was in the past, when, of course, doctors could do very little except avoid killing patients with harmful things. Now the problems are rather that we can keep people alive, when in the past they would have died.
Well, indeed, the old Hippocratic Oath contains elements of restrictive practice, that doctors agree not to operate on patients who have bladder stones or kidney stones. But it was much more uncompromising about abortion and euthanasia. And, I mean, what have you done about those two still controversial issues?
It was ambiguous about both. For example, in relation to abortion, it said that one must not give a patient anything which would cause them harm. That's because the kind of procedures used to carry out an abortion in the past were very dangerous to the mother. Whereas nowadays, of course, where it is felt it's justified to abort the pregnancy, that can be done with almost complete safety. The trouble at the other end of the age scale, of course, with so-called euthanasia, is demands, because of survival of the very elderly and some of the appalling diseases they suffer, demands in some quarters that doctors should change from the role of healer and become, in effect, a kind of killer on demand. And that, of course, we will not consider.
Now, hasn't the BMA been rather courageous in taking on the updating of this document? Because however smoothly you may think you've glided over some of these controversies, I'm sure a lot of people will feel that you've erred too much in one direction or another.
Well, I'm bound to say, as I'm going to have to pilot this through the Council and then the General Assembly of the World Medical Association, with people taking up, I imagine, pretty entrenched positions at either extreme, I'm well aware that we've taken on, I think, a fairly rash task. But somebody had to do it.
Dr. Sandy Makara, Chairman of the British Medical Association. Still to come, we've a report from the West Bank after another day of Middle East strife. And later, you can hear a snatch of what Elvis, King of Rock and Roll, sounds like in Latin. You're listening to BBC World Service. This is Hugh Prycer-Jones with NewsHour. A summary now of the latest world news. Here's John Jason.
A ship packed with people trying to flee Albania has capsized in heavy seas off the Italian coast. Four are reported dead. The Albanian president, Sali Berisha, has welcomed the idea of foreign troops protecting aid convoys in the country. The United Nations Security Council is considering sending a multinational force. The rebel forces of Laurent Kabila are reported to have taken another town in their advance on the key Zairean city of Lubumbashi. Reports from southeastern Zaire say Kasenga has fallen, leaving the rebels just 10 hours' drive from the capital of the mineral-rich Shaba province. President Clinton's Middle East envoy Dennis Ross has ended 2 days of talks with Palestinian and Israeli leaders, but he gave no indication that the current tension between the two sides had been eased. The 39 members of the Heaven's Gate cult in California who apparently committed mass suicide have explained their actions in a videotape. It shows the cult leader saying they were all returning to space from where they had come. The Dutch authorities say a fire which killed 6 members of a Turkish family in The Hague on Wednesday was started deliberately. A mother and her 5 children died in the blaze in a mainly Turkish neighborhood. Police have begun removing valuables from the Los Angeles home of the former American football star O.J. Simpson. Among the possessions taken away were a Chevrolet car, sports trophies, and framed letters from President Nixon. Damages of more than $30 million were awarded against Mr. Simpson after he was found liable in a civil case for the deaths of his former wife Nicole and her friend Ronald Goldman. Hugh.
Little sign of progress today for the Middle East peace process after more rioting on the West Bank. Palestinian police made a far more public effort today to restrain youths pelting Israeli soldiers with stones, but Palestinian anger seemed greater than ever, and the Israeli government continued to insist it would not negotiate until the violence stopped. Dennis Ross, President Clinton's Middle East envoy, on his way back to Washington, expressed pessimism about achieving anything in the near future.
One thing that's clear as I leave is that it's essential to reestablish calm. If there is going to be a way to find the means and the best methods for moving forward, we have to have an environment of calm.
Israeli public opinion, increasingly skeptical about peace, has hardened further after the latest suicide bombing by Hamas. But then Palestinian opinion is hardening too. Our correspondent Paul Adams has been travelling in the West Bank today and sent us this report.
On the road outside Ramallah, another skirmish between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian stone throwers. 100 yards of stone-strewn road separates the two sides. Up the road where the Palestinians are, there are burning tires. Both sides seem to be operating on the same understanding that an all-out confrontation is in no one's interest. The local Israeli army commander, Major General Uzi Dayan, is on hand to give a briefing.
We are not looking for a confrontation. If the Palestinian police will fulfill its mission, there won't be any tanks and any troops in this region.
No one's been killed yet in this past week. Do you think both sides learned the lesson from last September?
We are doing our best to bring security in this area. We are not trying to kill any band. We are not trying even that there will be one kid injured in this place.
In 9 days of protests, no one has yet been killed. The apparent restraint shown by both sides must offer Dennis Ross some shred of comfort. But if the situation has yet to degenerate completely, this cannot hide the fact that the peace process is in deep trouble. Benjamin Netanyahu says it's up to the Palestinians to save it.
What is required is a restoration of trust by swift and determined and continuous action on the part of the Palestinian Authority against the terror organizations.
But for Palestinians, the violence is not the cause of the current crisis, merely one of its many symptoms. Hanan Ashrawi is the Palestinian Minister of Higher Education and an experienced negotiator in her own right.
The Palestinian reactions are the actions of protest. They are not the actions that came out of the blue or not actions that were instigated by Palestinians. So what we have to do is deal with the real reasons that the peace process is in trouble.
This, say Palestinians, is the real root of the problem. For more than a week, bulldozers have been carving deep scars into the side of Jebel Abu Ghneim, the hill the Jews call Har Homah. The government's plan to build a Jewish settlement here on the edge of Jerusalem on occupied land sparked the street protests. The government says it's just a housing project. For Palestinians, it's much, much more.
I think the bulldozers are symbolic of everything that is going wrong. In the sense, you know, power politics, dictates, domination, the settlement issue, the Jerusalem issue, all these are the problems with the peace process.
But Dennis Ross is unlikely to tackle such issues just now. What he wants is to restore calm. But at some point, matters of substance will have to be addressed. And for Benjamin Netanyahu, that means making a choice, says Yaron Ezrahi, a political scientist.
He has to decide now whether he is opting for a peace process or he chooses to engage in the theatrics of peace, which actually means nothing to the Palestinians and to the rest of the world. And if he chooses the second way, I believe he's going to lose on both fronts, because the Israeli public has not given this government a mandate to stop the peace process and face the violence that will ensue.
If Mr. Netanyahu does choose the peace process, then the feeling here is that he'll have to form a government of national unity, get rid of his right-wing colleagues in the cabinet, and bring back the architects of the Oslo Accords. Ephraim Sneh, who served in the previous Labour-led government, says he doesn't see it happening soon.
I think that only if such a government would have a different policy, a constructive, serious, sincere policy of peace, we, the Labour Party, may join such a government. We can't join the current government, no way.
On the streets, the confrontation goes on, but you get the feeling that both sides are waiting to see what happens next, stopping just short of a descent into all-out violence. Unless a breakthrough is found soon, that may be the next step.
That report from Paul Adams in the West Bank. A book launched in Cuba last night has spelt out more details of Cuba's military involvement in foreign wars in the 1960s and 70s. Luis Baez's book, entitled Declassified: Secrets of Generals, gives first-hand accounts by famous Cuban generals of their exploits, often as very young soldiers, in Argentina, Venezuela, Syria, and Angola. One of the soldiers, General Abelardo Coloma Ibarra, tells of setting up a base in Bolivia as the first stage in trying to start a guerrilla war in Argentina, home of Che Guevara, most famous of Cuba's international revolutionaries. Well, on the line now, I've got our correspondent in Havana, Tom Gibb. Tom, how many secrets have come out of the bag?
Well, there's nothing startlingly new, I don't think. Much of the book is the reminiscences of the revolution in Cuba itself and personal profiles of the 41 generals interviewed. However, when you look at the whole scope of Cuba's internationalist involvement in the 60s, 70s and 80s in sort of one under one cover, it is fairly astonishing. Most of the officers fought with Fidel Castro as teenagers. They rose to senior ranks very quickly afterwards, and then they were sent off to fight abroad. And to give an example, the chief of staff now, Ulises Rosales del Toro, he fought in the revolution as a teenager, then he went off at the age of 23 to head a Cuban force helping Algeria in a war against Morocco. After coming back from that, he was sent off and spent 14 months in Venezuela helping leftist rebels in an insurgency which didn't succeed there. And he was made chief of staff at the age of 38 in 1981, and he's been there ever since.
I know this is really historical material, but isn't it a little provocative with the United States, with its Helms-Burton legislation, trying to point a finger at Cuba as a troublemaker, and here are all these proud memories of spreading revolution abroad?
Well, I think one of the reasons why it's come out now is that they say they want to give their version of history before others come out with different versions. And in some ways, they can afford to do that now because the Cold War's over and it's not so immediately controversial. There's quite a few things which Cuba would like to, which they were at pains to point out, which are still argued about. One of them, for instance, was how many of these wars were fought on Cuban initiative and how many of them were fought on behalf of the Soviet Union. The Cubans deny that they were fighting as surrogates of the Soviet Union categorically, but I suspect that's an issue which will be argued about for some time to come.
The biggest Cuban effort abroad was, of course, in Angola, where they had something like 300,000 soldiers at one point. Any revelations there about the battles with the South Africans?
Well, there's a lot of personal anecdotes and quite a lot of details. One general, for instance, describes going up in a helicopter to coordinate Katusha rocket attacks on South African artillery positions. There's a lot of individual accounts from that war. I don't think there's anything which it probably wasn't known before, although some of the individual details are very, very interesting. It's one of the wars that they're most happy to talk about because, of course, they inflicted an almost conventional defeat on the South African forces there. And so in comparison to many of the missions, it was comparatively successful.
Tom Gibb in Havana, thank you. Still to come, I'll be hearing from a leading British scientist who says we should remember the medical breakthroughs that can come from cloning, of which the public, he says, is too much afraid. And we'll have a snatch of Elvis in Latin. You're listening to BBC World Service. This is Hugh Prycer-Jones with NewsHour. And a reminder of the headlines. An Albanian boat crowded with refugees has capsized in heavy seas off southern Italy. A search is going on for survivors. Rebels in eastern Zaire are reported to have captured another town just a day after agreeing to talks with the government. The United States envoy to the Middle East has completed talks in Israel with no sign that he's eased tensions over the peace process. And members of a cult found dead in California have explained in a video why they committed mass suicide. High-level contacts between foreign ministry officials from India and Pakistan began today, the first such meetings for 3 years. The new Pakistan Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, and the Indian Prime Minister, Mr. Devi Gowda, have agreed to try yet again to resolve the issue of Kashmir, over which the two countries have fought two wars since Kashmir's division at independence of the subcontinent 50 years ago. Indian police arrested leaders of the Hurriyat umbrella group campaigning for Kashmiri independence just before the talks started. So how much progress can be made? if not over the central issue of Kashmir, then at least over the disputed borderline. Daniel Lack in Delhi reports now on India's hopes and expectations.
It's early in the morning outside the visa section of the Pakistan High Commission in Delhi. Already a crowd of several hundred Indian Muslims is waiting. These people are the most obvious victims of 50 years of hostility between India and Pakistan. All come from families split by partition.
Actually, I want to attend the marriage ceremony of my cousin. But there is no guarantee whether I will get or not.
I came for a visa from Bombay. Actually, I married to a Pakistani girl from Karachi. And I married in 1985. But all the time I have to go on visit and she had to come from Pakistan to meet me.
It's difficult on the other side too, although India has unilaterally relaxed some of its travel provisions. Pakistan has yet to respond. The three wars and many unresolved issues that flowed from partition cast long shadows over the subcontinent. These talks could be the best chance yet of casting light on half a century of darkness.
I think since 1988, since the so-called honeymoon summit, where Rajiv Gandhi and Benazir Bhutto met in Islamabad, this is the most optimistic mood on the eve of a round of negotiations.
Shekhar Gupta is editor of the Indian Express and a veteran Pakistan watcher. His optimism isn't unbounded. He thinks Kashmir will remain a barrier to normal ties for quite some time. But India, at least, according to Shekhar Gupta, is ready to talk bread and butter issues like trade.
I think trade concessions is something on which India wants to move much faster because, one, India sees much less to lose there. Two, it goes along with the old Indian line that we can postpone the solution to most contentious issues like Kashmir and do things which can be done now, you know, following on Deng Xiaoping's advice to leave more difficult problems to a wiser generation to solve.
The last Indo-Pakistan Foreign Ministry Secretary talks broke down with no agreement in January 1994. India's Foreign Secretary then, J.M. Dixit, is now retired, but he thinks political changes in Pakistan bode well for the talks.
I compare the two Prime Ministers of Pakistan, Benazir and Nawaz Sharif. I have dealt with both of them, and I think Nawaz Sharif certainly is more practical about complex affairs. He's not abrupt and not impatient of about getting quick results. Benazir was not that way.
That may be so, but Mr. Dixit and others admit there's a certain predictability, a competing one-upmanship about Indo-Pakistan talks, that something like an industry has sprung up around the 50-year process of war, peace, and stop-start diplomacy.
There's the industry of these talks, and there is the other industry of the second track, people to people. But hopefully all these processes will generate a groundswell of public opinion which will make the political leadership, the power structures of both societies, to think deeply and be bold enough to be innovative, moving away from the old stances. Because unless you remain enmeshed in the old grooves, there will be no movement forward.
On the streets of Delhi, it's hard to find people who don't want innovation in Indo-Pakistan relations. A new generation of Indians is calling for a new approach to old problems. But it's still up to an earlier generation to take action.
Daniel Lack in Delhi. The successful cloning of Dolly the sheep by British scientists has excited many nervous comments from the press and even prompted President Clinton of the United States to call for investigations and a halt to US government funding of research on human cloning. Clearly, cloning technology has now reached the state in which a lot of science fiction nightmares become technically possible. But Lord Winston, a leading British scientist and head of the fertility clinic at the Hammersmith Hospital in London, has now spoken publicly about the potential medical benefits that can be achieved because of the latest cloning experiments. I spoke to Lord Winston earlier and asked him why he had no fears about cloning and saw the breakthrough as exciting.
Whilst I think it would be quite wrong to clone a human being, the idea of cloning human tissues is hugely valuable. Why shouldn't we, for example, clone skin cells for burns victims or bone marrow cells, people with leukemia? Because, as you know, people die of leukemia because they can't get a compatible bone marrow graft.
the problem is, this was presented as a matter of reproduction, and ordinary people quite naturally transfer their thoughts immediately to human reproduction, and then perhaps they see all the dangerous possibilities that might come from the technology.
Yes, I do agree with that completely. The people who did the work are excellent scientists, but really have, I regret to say, been appalling at their media communication. I mean, I do think that they should have taken much more trouble in explaining the value of what they had done and why it was so important to pursue it.
Well, it's more than that, isn't it, Lord Winston? Because a private company is involved, very large sums of money are involved. There is this great competition now between scientists. The general public don't view this sort of scientific research anymore as something that goes on quietly and prudently inside an ivory tower. There is a feeling that the pace is increasing and things are being run away with.
No, I think that that's wrong. When you talk about companies being involved, of course biotechnology companies are involved with these things. These are incredibly important developments for the British economy. And it would be absolutely wrong not to have companies involved. I mean, if we make a new drug in this country, which might be of benefit to human good, please God we can find a company that will actually, of course, market it, because the scientists can't develop the commercial aspects. Of course, clearly we need to regulate and to review and inspect and make sure that the right things are being done for human good. But I really don't see that this is an evil technology. I think it's a very good technology.
Now, if you're going to convince people of that, you have to give them reassurances, and if the politicians aren't doing it, then the scientists have to. But speaking from your position as one of the leading practitioners about human fertility, when you make a comment on cloning, people will think, ah, so it is to do with human reproduction, and they will become worried that whatever reassurances are given, that perhaps they're not worth a great deal.
I don't think I can accept that. You know, one of the things that medical scientists like myself have been doing for a very long time is being involved with transgenic technology. That's where we put genes into embryos, of course not human embryos, but mostly into mice, to try and create mice which then express a gene which might be of great value to study for the improvement of treatments of human diseases. Now, transgenic technology, which is much more powerful than cloning technology, has been with us for 20 years. And people like myself have been using it. But nobody suggests for a moment, anywhere, that this might be used in the human embryo. I mean, there is a complete and total agreement that this is not something that's acceptable. And nobody's argued about that before, and yet here we are suddenly getting worried about cloning. And there would be much more relevance in putting a new gene into a human embryo than trying to make an embryo from a different nucleus.
Lord Winston, head of the fertility clinic at Hammersmith Hospital here in London. Our sports news now, Gordon Farker has joined me. Gordon.
Two leading Albanian football teams will stage a charity match in the capital, Tirana, tomorrow. It's 2 months since the national championship was suspended because of the civil unrest in the country. David Coles reports.
Two of the best-known Albanian sides, Tirana and Partizani, are to meet in a charity match with the proceeds of the game destined for a local orphanage. The organisers say the game is supposed to carry a message of spiritual calm, and it'll be staged at the Tirana Stadium across the city from the National Stadium, which earlier this month was used for the evacuation of foreign nationals by helicopter. It's still not clear when nor if the National League Championship will be restarted. The game will coincide with the Albanian national team's World Cup qualifying fixture against Ukraine. That's being played on a neutral ground in Granada in Spain.
The Swiss referee, Kurt Roethlisberger, who was handed a life ban by UEFA earlier this week, has strongly denied any wrongdoing. Speaking on national television in Switzerland, he threatened to make certain revelations if the ban remains. Richie Stevens reports.
Roethlisberger says he'll be lodging an appeal against the ban imposed by UEFA for allegedly trying to bribe the manager of the Zurich side, Grasshopper. Roethlisberger says he asked Eric Vergel what he'd say if someone came along and offered him 100,000 francs to bribe the referee before the club's game against Auxerre last October. Roethlisberger says he was simply curious to see how Vergel would react and denies it was a serious attempt to fix the game. He also said if he wasn't reinstated, then he'd make damning revelations about football, claiming that in his 12 years as an international referee, he'd heard and seen a lot, but kept quiet out of loyalty to UEFA.
Mark Taylor, the Australian cricket captain, has admitted that the pressure of captaincy has been undermining his batting and threatens his international career. Taylor's suffering a batting slump that stretches back over 15 months. He's gone 20 consecutive innings without a half century, the worst record of any Australian test batsman. And the Formula One motor racing circus is in Brazil, preparing for the second Grand Prix of the season on Sunday. Drivers and teams have been taking advantage of the free practice session in Sao Paulo, none more so than Ralf Schumacher, younger brother of the twice world champion Michael. Schumacher Jr. upstaged his sibling by setting a faster time around the circuit.
Elvis Presley, the late great American king of rock and roll, has millions of fans worldwide, and the lyrics from his songs have been translated into dozens of languages. But the latest homage to Elvis is perhaps the most unusual. A 52-year-old literature professor from Finland has just recorded an album of Elvis Presley's songs, translated into Latin, the language of the ancient Roman Empire and the Vatican, the headquarters of the Roman Catholic Church. Mark Coles reports.
Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll, a hit in just about every country in the world, the songs he made famous re-recorded in a host of different languages. But until now, never heard quite like this. Ursum tateum, pone colobingulum ductecum corculum me habetum. Elvis Presley in Latin. Tum tateum. It's the brainchild of Dr. Jukka Amund from Finland, a lecturer in literature at the University of Jyväskylä. Together with a classics colleague, he's translated a selection of Elv the Pelv's early rock and roll hits into Latin.
Blue sweat shoes in Latin, glauci calcei, and don't be cruel in Latin, ne se vias. And laudi mis claudi, ai nunc laudis is claudia.
Is it easy to sing Elvis Presley songs in Latin?
Oh, yes, yes. It is very, very, very easy. America but,
amare desit. The album, at the moment only available in Finland on Dr. Amont's own record label, features covers of rock and roll songs Presley made famous in the late 50s. Money Honey, All Shook Up, A Fool Such As I, and Kulina Mitratunk, Krepa Vasis Katilis, a Latin version of Shake, Rattle and Roll. Credo diabolum eset ebrachis nelonicis. Why record these songs in Latin?
Yes, why in Latin? How did I choose Latin? Latin chose me is more than correct. Latin is for me an eternal language.
This isn't the duo's first foray into Latin recording. A couple of years back, they recorded an album of Finnish tango music in Latin. It apparently went down a storm with the Vatican.
We received a very, very kind letter of thanks from the Pope.
So the Pope has been listening to your Latin albums?
Yes, yes, my tango album. I was very deeply moved by that gesture.
Do you think the Pope will be listening to your Latin Elvis Presley record?
The Pope likes Finnish tango music. Obviously, the Pope understood the deep melancholy message of Finnish tango. America but,
amare desit. There are melancholy moments too on the Rocking in Latin album. The tender I'm Left, You're Right, She's Gone, guaranteed to have them weeping buckets at the Vatican. What do you think Elvis Presley would have made of this? Elvis in Latin.
Elvis would be, I think he would like to this kind of intellectual humor.
Is there one more song you can maybe sing us?
Yes. Ursus Tadeus, Teddy Bear. Ductecum corculum me habetum,
tum Tadeum. That report by Mark Coles. A quick look at the leading headlines. An Albanian boat crowded with refugees has capsized in heavy seas off southern Italy. A search is going on for survivors. And rebels in eastern Zaire are reported to have captured another town, Kasenga, just a day after agreeing to talks with the government. Well, that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From everyone here, goodbye.